Episode of Progress, Potential, and Possibilities, discussions with fascinating people designing a better tomorrow for all of us. I'm your host, Ira Pastor.
Welcome, everybody, again to another episode of our show, bringing you another really fascinating guest today, helping to create a better tomorrow for many people in many different fronts. We have the honor today of being joined by Dr. Amber Salzman, who is the Chief Executive Officer and Director of Epic Bio, which is a fascinating new therapeutic gene editing startup. They're developing therapies that modulate gene expression at the level of the epigenome. They just recently emerged from stealth mode with a nice $55 million funding round. Dr. Salzman has over three decades of experience in the pharmaceuticals industry. Before joining Epic, she was the president and CEO of Ohana Biosciences, which was one of the industry's first sperm biology platform. She was also president and CEO of Adverum Biotech, a gene therapy shop. She began her career as a member of GSK's research and development executive team. She was responsible for operations and drug development across multiple therapeutic areas. She oversaw global clinical trials with over 30,000 enrolled patients, managed 1,600 employees at a $1.25 billion budget. Following her time at GSK, she was the CEO of Cardiokine, which was a pharma company developing treatments for the prevention of cardiovascular diseases. She got her bachelor's degree from Temple here in Philadelphia in computer sciences, holds a PhD in mathematics from Bryn Mawr College down the road. And in addition to developing therapies for unmet medical needs, advocating for patients with rare diseases, she also leads the Stop ALD Foundation, which is a nonprofit medical research foundation focusing specifically on novel gene therapies for adrenoleukodystrophy. A lot of exciting topics to get into today. Dr. Amber Salzman, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Very exciting.
Yeah, no, it's extremely exciting background. And you know, I would love to start off, I spent some time sort of reading about you and a little bit about the past. I would love to hear a bit about your early journey, Amber, not just sort of traveling the world, Michigan, Israel, Philly, New York, studying computer sciences, but ultimately how somebody that's working in the pharma industry has time to publish a dissertation on the arithmetic genus of threefolds defined by extended Hilbert modular groups. And if you can merge that story together for us, I would love to hear about it.
That's an interesting question. So I did get my undergraduate in computer science. But I will say this was at a time when really computers were, I'm embarrassed to say, were not pervasive. So because I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, I thought if I studied computers, I could really apply it to almost anything. And in fact, it did open the door through some good serendipitous meetings to go into a medical research environment. But as I started my career at Smith, Kline, and French, which ultimately became GSK, I realized I need more than just an undergraduate. I need to learn more. And also just personally, I kind of craved having a deeper academic background. And when I was thinking about what I would study, I know this sounds crazy because I was working in research development for therapies, but I thought, you know what? I really maybe this was naive. It was like, I always liked math. I was good at math. I know I'll get a PhD. And in retrospect, I mean, I don't know what I was thinking. Like, I'm good at math, you know, I can do that stuff. So therefore I'll get a PhD. I mean, in retrospect, I was good at arithmetic, which is very different than math. And but I was very fortunate to have some strong supporters in my career and in my personal life that said, yeah, go for it. So that's what brought me into math. And I thought I would do, just to your point about the thesis, I thought I would go into looking at modeling biological systems, that it was very relevant to my day job. But when I started studying, I just was fascinated by algebraic number theory, which is about as theoretical as you can get and far away from applied that I was thinking of. And I just got fascinated and got into it. And that's what drove I don't know if that answers it. I mean, some of it was naivete, I will say, and some of it was just passion and excitement around it. And I do find that math does really help in a broad sense, the way you think. And I mean, it sounds silly to say it helps me in my day job now, but it does, because it does make you think that even when a problem seems untractable, if you really persevere, often you can attack it.
Excellent, excellent, and yeah, you spent this amazing career at GSK. I was there for a little bit while you were there, but sort of a different part of the organization. Amazing portfolio pipeline. You're involved in developing it. You move from big pharma, and you get into various development stage biotech companies. Some developing what I'll just call the traditional things that we think about as drugs, and a lot of the stuff we were marketing and selling at GSK. You get involved in some more non-traditional stuff in terms of the gene therapy, in terms of sperm biotechnology, and all that. Talk a little bit about that part of your journey as well, because again, it's one thing, to manage all this research, but at the same time, a lot is very different once you get to the smaller development stage shops that are, starting from essence, nothing, and building some up. Talk a little about your experience there as well.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I was looking across therapeutic areas, broad patient populations at GSK, when about 20 years ago, unfortunately, my oldest nephew was diagnosed with adrenoleukodystrophy. That's a rare neurodegenerative genetic disease. And unfortunately, when he was diagnosed, we learned that it was probably too late to do something for him, because by the time he was diagnosed properly, it was fairly advanced. But when we learned it was genetic, we tested the rest of the family. And I found that my son, who was 1 year old at the time, also tested positive with the mutation, as did another nephew. And at first you feel paralyzed, like, oh my God, how could this happen? I've been doing therapy development my whole life. How can we not help these boys? But I reached out almost the day after we got the diagnosis. And at the time, I was reporting it to the chairman of R&D, Tachi Yamada. And I said, look, Tachi, I've got a few more years and then the bomb goes off and the other two boys, what do I do? I need to find a treatment. And this was, I should set the context for those who follow gene therapy. It was shortly after the infamous death of Jesse Gelsinger at the Penn trial. And so nobody was really excited about gene therapy, but Tachi, being a very forward thinker, said, you know what, Amber, call my friend Jim Wilson at Penn. You got to take a gene therapy approach. It's a monogenic disorder. He read a lot of the material I did, and there were not really that many promising advances. And because of Tachi's connection, I sat down with Jim, and I'll never forget the meeting where we literally mapped out this is what it'll take to develop a gene therapy treatment for ALD, and reached out to some of the experts in the field. It's a very cross-disciplinary area, just because of all the different tools you need to bring to the table and technologies. And based on that work, we and a lot of really amazing people who contributed really just out of wanting to do something for these kids, we did have the first non-HIV Lenti ex vivo gene therapy treatment, and that was published in Science in 2009. And then another venture capital firm invested in that and licensed it from the investigators we were working with. And I'm really pleased to say that now, 20 years later, It's been approved in Europe, and I mean the company Bluebird took it forward, did an amazing job, and it got approved in Europe, and it's going for approval in the US, and the advisory committee voted positive on that. So while I was doing that basically as a night job while I was an executive at GSK, and through that definitely evolved professionally, personally. And I remember Tachi, again, being a forward thinker, said, "You know, Amber, your next job should really be CEO of a biotech." And at the time, I just it didn't register, but that's sort of Tachi. He was always like 10 years ahead of people. And then it kind of sat and resonated. So when I was looking at what was going on at GSK and in biotech, and really what when I put my passion into it, what I could do to help in terms of ALD, I also got newborn screening or, along with many others, onto the recommended uniform screening panel. I thought, I feel like I can be a lot more powerful if I work in a small biotech environment than, I mean, look, big pharma is amazing and I learned so much and was able to do a lot, but I thought that was the time to move my journey to small pharma. And that's what brought me into Cardiokine, which at the time, there was one of the investors was Jan Leschly, who was the former CEO of SmithKline Beecham. So that was that connection. So he brought me into Cardiokine. After selling Cardiokine, that was when I thought my day job and my night job could actually merge. And that was when I founded a gene therapy company for rare diseases. And that's where that took off. So I know it's a really long-winded answer, but I hope that answered your question.
No, it was a great answer, and it brings me right now to what you're doing today, Epic Bio, and sort of before we get into some of those technologies, I'd love to have just a short talk about the epigenome. It's a topic that we've gotten into on this show primarily from the perspective of say developmental biology. You know, we have the 25,000 protein coding genes. They're the same all across our cells, yet there's these important little differences that sit above the genome that, you know, make muscle muscle, that make a neuron a neuron, and so forth. That they also do fascinating things that define left and right, and lots of things the epigenome does. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the epigenome from the perspective of, on one hand, the chronic degenerative diseases that we all experience, but at the same point, because you're very active in the rare genetic disorders as well, talk about the epigenome there, because we don't normally think about them sort of in the same basket, but there really is some interesting overlap, and we'll get into the biotech in a little bit.
Yeah, let's see if I can answer, because in some ways, yeah, they look distinct, but they're very related. So when it comes to the single gene mutations, as you mentioned, what I feel like now, even in the lay press, people feel comfortable talking about DNA. So we're comfortable that we all have DNA and we have genes,
We've been
and
there.
yeah, so we're kind of there. But what you know, if we push that a little bit further, and as you said, I have the same DNA in my muscle cells as my neurons, but somehow they know how to act differently. And what I also find, another example is I have the same DNA I had when I was little, and I sure as hell don't look the same as I did then. And unfortunately, we're all aging. So it's the same DNA. There's something else going on. And I think that something else going on is such a huge power to take on. So when it comes to the genetic diseases, often you'll find a mutation, a single mutation, which causes either a mutant protein to express or a good protein not to express. So if we look above, as I call epi, above the DNA and say, gee, how can we fix that? How can we either stop that mutant protein from expressing or have the wild type protein express? How can we control that? And that's where the epigenetic programming comes in, because if we program the chemistry above the DNA, then we can almost tell the DNA more what to do. So, you know, in a simplistic form, as we both said, the chemistry is there to make the muscle cell act like a muscle cell, even though it's the same DNA as a, you know, liver cell. But if we can harness that, that's where we can either shut down the bad proteins expressing in a genetic disease and express proteins that are missing. But the reason why I say that ties very easily into the non-genetic diseases is that if we think about the more common diseases or not single gene mutations, it's still a matter of, is good protein expressing, bad protein expressing? You know, if you think about our tools that we use today, we try to inhibit things, we try to express things. So the more we understand about disease, the more we can leverage controlling it at the epigenome level. So I sort of feel like I'm so excited to be sitting on this platform of technology that can do all that. Now we're hampered by the fact that we don't really understand the more complex diseases than the single mutations. So that's why while I'm working in epigenetic engineering, our initial pipeline is looking at the, as I would call, the more simply understood or biologically validated diseases. It very easily can move into some of the others. And when we think about, I mean, unfortunately, I personally have experienced and others have experienced, you know, where you go after a common disease and you know it's complicated, but you have really exciting phase two data and you go into phase three and all of a sudden it bombs. Well, what happened? Even if you recruit the similar types of patients, the diseases are more complicated. And if we're only going after one pathway, you may or may not get so lucky in a different group of people in phase three. But if we really understood all of the pathways and we went after all of them, then you wouldn't have such discrepancies between a phase two and phase three. I mean, I think about NASH, like, unfortunately, there's a lot of, you know, compounds that haven't made it. And I don't think it's because there wasn't good science there. It was just, it was looking at one piece of the science. But if you looked across it and understood more holistically what the causes are, and you addressed all of them with one therapy, you'd be more likely to be able to help all different patients and therefore have the more positive studies. So I feel like we're sitting on this tool that really sky's the limit. Now we have to open up our thinking to look at the complexity of diseases.
And continuing along those lines, and we'll get into the initial indications in a minute, but talk a little bit about sort of the technology platform, because I know that, you know, one of your other co-founders comes out of sort of the Duden CRISPR lineage there. Yet when I look at, and I'm not a scientist here, but I sort of, in going through sort of the GEMs or the gene expression modulation systems, it almost seems like, okay, here's something that's like CRISPR. It gets there, but it doesn't chop up the DNA like CRISPR does. It's sort of a force to, hey, here's where we need to go. And then there's these other cool things that are, there's other cool magic it's bringing along to play with the epigenome. Talk a little bit of that, if you would.
And just to reassure you, I've talked to very sophisticated scientists who also, if they haven't studied this, they don't get it. So this is So I hope I don't oversimplify too much, but just to add clarity. So as you noted, you know, Jennifer Doudna, who won Nobel laureate for the CRISPR-Cas9 system, you know, at Berkeley, the founder of our company, Stanley Chi, with her lab, and he's named on that patent. Yep. And what CRISPR was incredibly powerful in doing was it could very flexibly be programmed to bind to the right gene mutation. And that's where the power of CRISPR comes in, because there's been other technologies that could bind to it and cut it, but it was really each disease took a lot of time. It was just not, it didn't have the flexibility of the CRISPR-Cas9 system. So that's where this, all of a sudden, this massive power of being able to program it so readily came with CRISPR. And as you noted, the original CRISPR technology took the approach of when it binds to that mutant protein, it chops it out, and then the DNA binds to get rid of that. However, as you also noted, that's a double strand break. And while you may be doing something really great in terms of ameliorating some mutation, you may also cause some off-target effect in terms of when you do a double strand cut. So what Stanley did was he said, look, what if I took the power of CRISPR to be able to hone in on the right place and program it so flexibly, but instead of actually cutting DNA, I add what I would, or I'll say, I fuse a modulator, as I would say, to that Cas molecule. And instead of cutting it, let me back up. You take the Cas molecule. First, you deactivate it so that it can't cut, but you have the honing power to go to the right place. And since you can't cut it, you fuse a modulator to it so that you can then control the epigenome. So you may want to upregulate or downregulate, and that's where the modulator comes in at the epigenome level. So you may actually remove or add a methyl or acetyl group on a histone, or you may activate the transcriptome or repress the transcriptome. And basically what that does is it tells the DNA, you know, do more, do less, stop completely, but it doesn't actually cut the DNA. It just instructs it what to do. So I feel like I didn't explain this well, but I'm trying to say we use
it's great.
it's the programmability of CRISPR. Yeah. But without the cutting, and instead we fuse a modulator to it to instruct the DNA what it should be doing. I hope that explained it.
No, it was spot on. Yeah. And the fact that I understood it from the beginning, no, that was perfect. I appreciate that very much.
And of course, we still use the guide RNA as the original CRISPR approach did in terms of finding the right gene target. So it's that whole powerful CRISPR system, but working at the epigenome.
Awesome. So you raised the initial $55 million. It's going to be supporting a range of programs of the initial indications, and I'm going to mispronounce some of these, fascioscapular humeral muscular dystrophy, heterozygous familial hypercholesterolemia, two types of retinitis pigmentosa, and alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. I know the list of rare monogenic genetic disorders is extensive, thousands of them. Talk a little bit about why these five. Yeah. I mean, they sound really scary and you know, obviously they're important, but talk a little bit about how you picked these five and what's happening right now.
Yeah, as you said, unfortunately, there's thousands of these diseases. So when we looked at where we can apply this powerful technology, we thought, okay, how can we very rapidly prove or validate and de-risk our technology? And we thought, okay, what things can we already use that are de-risk? So let's go after a disease where at least the biology is understood. Mm-hmm. And I'll take our lead indication to help talk this through. So if you take FSHD, fascioscapular humeral dystrophy, it's very well established that the problem with that disease is that there's hypomethylation at the D4Z4 region, which basically just means that people, and therefore, because of that hypomethylation, so in other words, the instructions at the epigenome level telling the DNA what to do, mm-hmm. because it's hypomethylated, it lets the DUX4 express, which in you and I, it doesn't, because there's enough methylation. If you remethylated it, you wouldn't have the DUX4 expression. Mm-hmm. DUX4 is very toxic to muscle, and that's what causes the unfortunate progression of FSHD. So it's very well understood. It's actually recent science, but within the last 20 years, but it's very well understood, very well established that that's the root cause of the disease. Mm-hmm. So knowing that, we could say, all right, well, we know what our tool does. So if our tool works properly, and we could remethylate that region, we could suppress that protein and therefore stop the disease. So in other words, we picked a disease where the biology was well understood. And if our technology did the right thing, we'd have a nice treatment for patients. The other challenge is, we have this really great construct that if it got there, it would remethylate it and tell the DNA to do the right thing. But how do we get there? So then I go back to my history in gene therapy and say, a big challenge in gene therapy is getting your treatment to the right cells to do its thing. So then I looked at, there's been a lot of there's been a lot of experience using an AAV vector to deliver gene augmentation to patients. Now there's only two products approved in the US, but there's a lot of experience. This is all very new, recent science. And then I said, if we're using AAV, that's one advantage that, for example, our technology has over others, because what I didn't get into earlier is that the original Doudna work had a CRISPR-Cas9 molecule, and Cas9 is a molecule that's actually pretty big and doesn't fit in an AAV vector, so you couldn't deliver it easily. What our founder did was come up with it, what we call Cas-Mini, which is a Cas molecule that's half the size. So that's one thing. So we knew we could fit in an AAV. So then we said, okay, if we look at the thousands of patients that have been dosed with AAV, where have we seen success in terms of delivery? So we've seen that it gets its way to the liver, whether you like it or not. It usually gets to the liver. We've seen that it gets to the eye. We've seen from a lot of the Duchenne work, there's been a lot of trials in Duchenne, that it gets to the muscle. So we said, okay, why don't we, when it comes to CNS indications and some of the others, there's a mixed bag in terms of can you actually get there? And there's a lot of companies focused on it who are making great successes in terms of delivering. But again, we took the approach of let's de-risk the delivery, let's de-risk the biology, and then let's just test our construct. So with that in mind, as I mentioned, FSHD, the biology is well understood. When it comes to delivering it, we're going to leverage all that work done in Duchenne, where it's been seen that there's AAV vectors that get to the muscle, and there's a good safety profile, and there's data suggesting that at least half of the myocytes, the muscle cells, are getting what it's supposed to get delivered. So I took the approach, or we, I should say, we took the approach of let's de-risk as much as we can, and therefore the only real novel piece would be our technology. So that's, I mean, I talked through the first and the lead indication, but that's the approach we took for all of them. Is the biology well understood that if our product did what it was supposed to, it would help the disease? And is the delivery approach somewhat de-risked that we know that the AAV vector can get there? And just to add, we don't have to use an AAV. We can use Lenti or the new modern LNPs. It's just they don't make its way into the tissues that we're going after. I don't know if that explains, like, that we took a de-risk approach just to test ours. Once we validate that, then we can be much more expansive in terms of which diseases to go after. There is no such thing as low-hanging fruit in therapy development, but we try to de-risk it as much as possible.
Yeah, no, it's, I think you've done that perfectly. And the fact that, now, in a sense, once you have de-risked in this kind, you can go to that list, whether it's 6,000 or 8,000 rare diseases, and do it over and over again. That's, that's extremely exciting. At the same time, and once again, when you go to the Epic Bio website, you scroll down past those five indications, you get to this other fascinating sort of next step, where you talk about multiplex suppression and activation. And I thought this was extremely fascinating in the sense, we had just talked about, yeah, I mean, there's going to be application here in the chronic degenerative diseases that still represent and kill most of us. And with what's going on, say, like, for instance, the last couple of weeks in the Alzheimer's field, when I read through this, not only, for instance, could this technology suppress something that we don't want happening, but you point out on the website, for instance, you may be able to add a feature in the case that you highlight neuroprotection. So, it seems like this technology, if you think that a future, okay, here's something like Alzheimer's, okay, maybe we want to get rid of some of this amyloid beta, but maybe we want to impart a function at the same time to protect those cells. Talk a little bit about, obviously you're not doing it today, but a little about the multiplex side of this, if you would.
You really explained it well. I'm going to have to use our comms person. But yes, that's exactly right. That one, but part of the challenge is, do we understand the diseases well enough to know what we want to shut down, what we want to overexpress, or even express at a certain level? And that's where the tunability of our products come in. So right now, there's some diseases, like as you mentioned, we're looking at familial hypercholesterolemia. Without getting into too many details, there's some proteins you want to shut down, and there's some you want to overexpress. So that's where the power of our tool can come in. Again, we're going after where the biology is more well established. But as you said, there's thousands of diseases, and what gets me up in the morning and staying up late is thinking about all the patients we can help. And that's where I'm hoping that once we get out there and validate our technology, the other companies, academicians, and people that care about their disease and understand it way better than we do will come and work with us to leverage our technology. Because we can't go after, no matter how big we get, we can't go after all the diseases. And I just feel like it would be we need to get the tool out there to help the patients. So the people who are really studying a disease and understand what needs to, you know, I'm not an Alzheimer researcher, but if somebody really understood what they think should go down and go up, I would love to work with them so that they could leverage our tool and figure out if it could help. And, you know, we have also a very powerful screening group here, and I would love to help test out some of their hypotheses with them. So yeah, that's where the multiplex comes in, and where I think because we have been limited in our tools to address disease, we just haven't thought about diseases on as many levels. We sort of go after one pathway. And that's a little oversimplification, but you know, we just have a lot more to understand, and then we can use some of these types of tools.
Well, absolutely. Amber, you know, at the beginning, you know, you talked about the story and your experiences of sort of moonlighting with the ALD work. In 2008, you published at the time The Key to the Kingdom, The Challenge of Rare Diseases. And then only a couple of years later, in 2011, in Human Gene Therapy, you talk about the journey that you told us about in terms of turning despair into a gene therapy breakthrough. Obviously, you're at the point, and I take my hat off to you, and I say this with all respect, that you're probably not the type anymore that needs to like do a tremendous amount of road showing to raise capital for some of these types of initiatives. But as you pointed out, in the middle of, you know, gene therapy problems, you were able to, you know, move a gene therapy along and get excitement, get funding, and so forth. Any tips at this point, here we are in 2022, for young innovators, startups, maybe university lab folks that may have, you know, cutting edge ideas at the same point, but aren't the Amber Salzman at the end of the world that can snap their fingers and get $55 million to do something new.
If it was only that easy. But to your point about it, look, it is never easy for anyone. I always talk about the overnight success that takes 25 years. Like, no matter what, it's hard. But what I would, in terms of advice, one is that you really shouldn't, anybody who has an idea that they think will be helpful, don't underestimate what you can do. Like the power of one person. And this is something that when I started in the patient advocacy group, there weren't as many patient groups at the time. Now there's a lot. And I often talk to other patient advocates and I'll have people say, yeah, but I don't have your science background. I don't have your, you know, pharmaceutical background. I'm like, that's not it. You have the passion and drive to do something for your disease. Don't underestimate what that gets you. You really can't. That's one. So keep that passion. The other thing is really, really listen. So when you go to investors, instead of just walking away like, oh my God, I heard a no, what you really have to hear is, and to help dissect, is what would have turned that no to a yes? Not that you can usually go back to that same investor and turn the no into the yes, but really take it on board. Hear what they said, pause and say, okay, well, is there a way that I can do some experiment or something? Is there a way that if that question came up again, we'd have a better answer for it? And sometimes, I mean, it's just human nature. When you hear no, you know, we just can't hear that much negativity. So you don't really spend the time absorbing what they're saying. And some of what they're saying may absolutely be wrong, but that they're the ones with the money and you have to meet them where they are. And this is kind of to my point earlier when I said, I talked to some really good scientists who don't completely understand. I didn't understand until I came here. Not that I'm an expert now, but if you don't work at the epigenome, you don't fully appreciate it. So a lot, I'll talk to investors who come in and have a very different perception. Like they'll say, oh yeah, but your tool isn't durable. And it's like, well, yeah, it is. So clearly, instead of hearing they're wrong, I have to hear, I didn't explain this well. I did not make it damn clear that I'm not relying on AAV. I'm relying on the fact that epigenetic programming gets inherited from one cell to the daughter cell. And the next time I talk to an investor, I better really hone in the way that I explain it. So part of it is really, my only advice is feel really, get more confident. If you believe in what you're doing, that passion and that power will take you through the bad times, and really hear what people say. And like I said, it's hard to go back to a no person and turn them into a yes. But if you take your time listening to the first several no's, incorporate that, either learn how to speak about it better or do some study. Because sometimes it's not that you said it wrong, you just don't have the data. And obviously, whoever you talk to wants more data than you have. That's just the way it is, but see what you can do and see how you can de-risk it. And look, it's hard. I mean, it's hard for me too, but I really, at the end of the day, like I said, I get excited. I mean, I laugh. I get up. I mean, this morning I got up at 3:45 in the morning. I was so excited to go to work. Like, I was thinking about how much we could be doing for patients, and there was some work we did yesterday that I want to continue today. And if you're that excited about it, you can do it.
Excellent points. Amber, one last thing while I have you today, and I so appreciate your time, but say a couple words about the lizards, and do you still have pet lizards, and why were they all named Pete?
It's funny because when the person pulling our, we have a really fun culture here. So when the person was pulling our website together, they said, give a fun fact about yourself. I was like, I don't know. I'm so serious sometimes. I don't have anything fun. And then I was talking about lizards. They're like, well, talk about your lizards. And you always had lizards. So when I was living in Israel as a kid, you know, I always wanted pets. And, you know, I grew up with three other siblings. So there's four of us. My parents had a lot going. All of us are, you know, my mother had, you know, four kids in the span of 6 years. So that's not easy for anyone. So if you say you want a pet, you can assume the answer is no. Like, we can barely take care of four kids, much less a pet. Sure. So I was like, if I'm going to get a pet, how do I get a pet? Well, if you live in Israel, you see lizards running around all the time. It's like, oh, I'll get my own pet. So that was the reason for the lizards, because I could literally catch a pet and keep it. I shouldn't say this until it dies, but you can. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to keep lizards as pets. So they were my fun pet to have lizards. And I don't know how we ended up the first one. I think it may have even my sister's like, oh, is that Petey? I was like, okay, it's Pete. So, and I've got to tell you, as much as I like lizards, they really do all look the same to me, except for maybe the size. So they kind of, as you lost one, you got the next one, and therefore you didn't have to mourn the loss. You had your newer, younger Petey. But that's the lizard story.
Cool. No, we did a couple of lizard episodes, actually. And I was going to link it back to the fact that they have really cool epigenetics going on there with regard to tail regeneration and limb regeneration, all that stuff. But that's for another episode. But Amber, this was exciting. I mean, I really enjoyed not just talking, you know, about your whole story, but everything you have going on in Epic Bio is really cool. And I'm just going to keep following it continuing to root you on. One last thing, anything hot coming up for the rest of 2022, conferences we can see you and meet you at, other initiatives, anything else that I might have missed? Please take the floor.
I will just say that everything I'm saying, I can only talk about it because we have literally the most amazing team I've ever worked with. And when I say some scientists don't understand, I asked the dumbest questions when I joined, and only because I'm surrounded by really smart, intellectually curious, humble people could I do what I'm doing, because they entertained my dumb questions, taught me, and did everything. So I will say that it is an amazing team here, and our founder, Stan Lee, she is also brilliant and humble, and I think that's what enables us to hear and learn. We do have my head of technology development, Dan Hart, is speaking at a conference in December, an epigenetic. Well, it's actually gene editing. We may be the only epigenetic editors. The others may be more DNA editors. So that's early December. We have a lot of stuff coming out, and our intention is to do more in conferences and get some of our data out there, because we really want other people to leverage it to address diseases.
Awesome. For everybody that is going to be listening to this episode across the various podcast networks or watching on the YouTube channel, again, you've been listening to Dr. Amber Salzman, Chief Executive Officer and Director, Epic Bio, doing fascinating things in terms of epigenetic editing and rare diseases, eventually chronic degenerative diseases. Amber, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to come talk to us for a little while about these amazing things. Obviously, thank you for doing them. And as we say on our show here, thanks for helping to create a better tomorrow for so many people via what you're doing. Really amazing story.